I'm David. I'm from the Lowell Observer.
Between the rag and the injury, his voice was especially high and nasal. Carrie got a clean roll of paper towel from the pantry, then filled a plastic bag with ice from the freezer. Applied to the bridge of the nose, the bag of ice reduced the swelling and the pressure, and the bleeding stopped after a minute or two. What the heck happened? David smiled sheepishly and shook his head.
It was my fault, he said. Really, I'm to blame here, not Adam.
Carrie gave David a fresh paper towel and refilled his plastic bag with ice. She studied her patient. Probably around her age, he had attractively messy hair and a kind face. She suspected he was something of a charmer. Go on, Carrie said. I'm all ears.
I came here to interview Adam for a story I'm writing about PTSD. But your mother showed up and Adam had a change of heart. No longer wanted to talk.
Carrie grimaced. You didn't take no for an answer, did you? David laughed, and Carrie thought the sound was warm and inviting. He was obviously embarrassed, but he had enough humility to see a little humor in it.
Not my style, he said. I didn't think I was being pushy, but I don't back down so easily.
Carrie thought of her conversation with her dad. Neither do I, she realized. Chapter 12. After prying his eyes open, Steve Abington could not make sense of what he saw. He knew this place intimately, but for the life of him, he could not figure out how he had returned. The last thing he remembered was what? Nothing came to mind. He felt as if he had been living in absolute darkness, the blackest infinity, until this very moment, until light flooded his eyes and he saw again the desolate farm field where it all began. Abington tried to stand, but he felt weighed down. It took a moment to realize he was wearing an ILBE pack, one so fully packed he had to hunch over while getting to his feet. He also held a rifle, an M4 rifle fitted with an M68 red dot optic. Where had that come from? And what else did he have on? Cautiously, Abington reached up and felt the Kevlar of an advanced combat helmet. He wore a multicam pattern uniform, too. How did that get on him? Why was he here? He thought he was through with all this. Steve. Steve, can you hear me? Abington spun in a tight circle, but saw no one. The voice, one he did not recognize, came out of the ether. He circled once more and this time noticed foxholes, several of them. Nearby stood a makeshift structure, like a tree stand, but on the ground. It was covered in green camo netting, and he thought he remembered putting it together. It was a command operations center, which meant this place must be the security outpost for Forward Operating Base Darwin. Yes, of course it was. There was the tree line 100 meters out. Beyond those trees, the snow-capped Hindu Kush mountain range cut a jagged tear across an endless azure horizon. If he walked west about 2 clicks, Abington was sure he'd find the remote roadway his squad had been patrolling. The Taliban were setting IEDs along the MSR, main supply route, and his unit used that road to make a quick exit. Steve! That voice again. Bodiless. Everywhere and nowhere. Where was it coming from? Lightning bolts erupted behind his eyes, making Abington's head throb. He trotted over to the nearest foxhole. The sunglasses tinted the world, but shielded his eyes against a steady wind's peppering of sand and dirt. Inside the spray of dust, thousands of chiggers and sand fleas took flight in search of soft targets. Steve! The voice. Was it in his head? Had he gone crazy? Had he never actually left this godforsaken place?
Hello?
Abington called. His voice had the grit of sandpaper, and his throat felt as dry as the ground. So dry, so thirsty.
Is anybody here?
The wind swallowed Abington's words. He crouched and dug his hands into the hard earth. It felt real. He managed to rake up a small pile of dirt using the tips of his fingers. This was how he described the country to anyone who asked. Dirt. Piles of dirt. Dirt everywhere you looked. The soil carried fungus that blew deep into blast wounds to fester and take away limbs that otherwise could have been saved. How was he back in this hellhole? Back guarding FOB Darwin? Had he ever even left? Abington remembered. He remembered everything about living here, including his squad. But where was everybody? His gaze fell back to the parched earth, and Abington saw a scorpion crawling by his feet. He crushed it beneath the heel of his well-worn military boot with a satisfying crunch. But what he really wanted to crush was the Taliban. A familiar burning hatred boiled up, warming Abington like Kentucky's best bourbon. There was no better feeling than sending coordinates up the satellite link and watching the ground evaporate where the hardware dropped. This was a backward country. No real infrastructure, no proper roads. Nothing here except for dirt and caves and Taliban. The only thing the Taliban respected was battle. They trained their young children to kill, and in their downtime played polo with dead animals. Pure savagery. Neanderthals with guns. Abington searched the horizon for any signs of life. This was a Tier 1 area, no civilians allowed. Any person with a full beard and loose-fitting robes could be legitimately engaged. But the landscape was as barren as the surface of Mars. He was alone. All alone.
Do you see it, Steve? Do you see what's happening?
Abington readied his rifle and trained the weapon in all directions. His eyes narrowed and he bared his teeth like cobra fangs. He could see nothing but dirt, trees, and the mountains in the distance.
He must be seeing it, the voice said. I don't see it.
Abington's voice came out as a whisper.
It's there, Steve. You can see it. You can see everything.
Abington glanced at the foxholes and caught a flash of movement from inside one of them. Was it just his shadow? How could that be? The sun was in front of him. Could he have imagined it? Abington moved cautiously toward that foxhole, his weapon at the ready.
Is anybody in there? Abington called out. Hello?
Abington took another step forward, then another. He could see a shape now, the silhouette of a figure, but it shimmered like a mirage. Abington advanced a couple more feet. From out of nowhere, a tracer whizzed above his head. In an instant, the air erupted with the sounds of gunfire snapping all around him. Bursts from a Russian PKM machine gun crackled in Abington's ears, rattling his teeth. Bullets pocked the earth and shattered rocks sprayed in all directions. Abington heard a whistle above him, like a screech from a bird of prey, followed by a loud thud somewhere to his back. An ear-splitting boom came next, causing the ground to shake beneath his feet. Abington turned and saw two billowing dust clouds no more than 20 yards away. This was Afghanistan. One moment all was quiet, and the next it was chaos. From the foxhole, somebody shouted, RPGs! RPGs! Abington broke into a sprint. The foxhole was safety. As he neared, a different shadowy figure lurched up from another hole and flashes exploded from his rifle. A second later, several mortars landed close by, and Abington heard shrapnel bounce off the heavy armor of some parked trucks. Wait, had those trucks been there before? Not now. Questions for another time. Abington dove headfirst into the closest foxhole. He hit the hard ground and felt the breath leave his body. Shockwaves from gunfire and erupting mortar punctured the air and echoed across the bleak landscape. The foxhole had room for two, and the man Abington had joined returned fire with his M16.
Steve, start shooting. Unless you're hit, put that gun to use, hombre.
Hombre. Only one person called him that. Abington squinted and his eyes strained. He could not see the man's face clearly, but he recognized the thin build and knew that reedy voice anywhere. PFC Rich Phillips, Roach, who, like the bug, couldn't seem to be killed. Eventually, the man came into clear focus, and the specter with the M16 was his best friend, all right. The same guy whose guts Abington had stuffed back into his blown-open stomach right after an RPG struck their foxhole.
Steve, what is it? What are you seeing?
The disembodied voice again. Look at his face, another voice said. He's right there. Chapter 13. Carrie could not shake the smile off her face. The occasional glint of sunlight slipping through a persistent cloud cover seemed intended just for her and buoyed her spirits. Her footsteps on her walk to the VA parking lot came quick and purposeful. She no longer felt directionless or adrift. After 2 hours with Dr. Alistair Finley, she could visualize some kind of future. It wasn't a fully realized vision, but a sprig of hope had sprung from her despair. Carrie could not help but think of the final line from Casablanca, which she had watched with her dad the previous night. "Louis, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship." It was funny that David Hoffman's bloody nose was partially responsible. His passion for his work, undaunted by a violent subject, had reminded her of herself. "I don't back down so easily." She'd been in no mood to socialize, but after Carrie cleaned David up, it was easy to say yes to an invitation to have coffee later. She was under no illusions about his motives. He wanted information about Adam and their family for his story. But he'd made her laugh.
"I usually only have coffee with rocket scientists," he said. "I guess I could slum with a brain surgeon."
Adam never came back to make amends, leaving Howard and Irene to do the apologizing.
"Don't even mention it,"
David had said with a wave of his hand. His battered nose would heal just fine.
"If it's okay with Adam, maybe we can try again sometime. People need to know what's happened to our servicemen and women. They need to see the war after the war."
For the rest of that night, Carrie thought only of her father's suggestion and David's persistence. She had come too far to quit. She called Dr. Finley's office at the VA the next morning. To Carrie's surprise, Dr. Finley answered his own phone. "My name is Carrie Bryan," she said. "My father, Howard, suggested I give you a call." For whatever reason, Carrie felt at ease with Dr. Finley. His voice was intimate, with no discernible accent, and he spoke to her as a colleague. He remembered her father and was interested in her background and experience.
"Can you come by the hospital this afternoon?"
he asked. Carrie hadn't expected that. It felt fast, but that was good. No chance to get cold feet. A few hours later, she was sitting in Dr. Finley's office anteroom, flipping through an issue of People magazine. 5 minutes later, she was in front of Dr. Finley himself. Unlike his fancy headshot on the VA website, Dr. Finley looked every bit the harried professor. His long hours showed in the silver that streaked his mop of wavy, light hair and in his pale cheeks and burrowed eyes. He might have been intimidating, except for his cheerful expression and a slightly disheveled appearance. Dr. Finley shook Carrie's hand firmly.
"Please come into my office, the executive suite," he said with a smile.
She wouldn't have called the attending's offices at Community comfortable, but they seemed luxurious compared to the decor here. Two metal folding chairs faced an L-shaped desk that looked like a Walmart special. An overhead fluorescent light fixture gave off a persistent hum. The walls were bare, except for a couple of diplomas and the requisite pictures of the president and the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. The VA reeked of institutionalism, like body odor. Still, the man seated at the desk had a warm and inviting smile. Carrie gazed out a square window that overlooked the parking lot, focusing on an adjacent multi-story brick building under construction. The building was covered in rusted scaffolding and tattered blue tarps, but Carrie could still see signage over the front entrance. VA Hospital Annex. Most of the windows on the annex were boarded up, but some remained intact. Dr. Finley noticed her looking.
"That was supposed to be our gleaming new facilities," he said, a bit wistful. "But we've been caught up in a bit of a funding crunch, I'm sorry to say. Work stopped almost 2 years ago."
"The building has been vacant this whole time?"
"Unfortunately, yes," Dr. Finley said. "There were ambitious plans for hospital expansion, but almost everything has been put on hold because of ongoing budget constraints. Perhaps one day the fortunes will change. But we're not here to discuss the fiscal woes of the VA.
"No, we're not," Carrie said, taking a seat on one of Dr. Finley's metal chairs. "My father sends his regards."
"He's a good man,"
Dr. Finley said of Carrie's father.
"That was a great time. Great. Internship was without a doubt the hardest year of my life. But it was probably the best, too. I want you to know he's not the reason I invited you down here. Your call may have come at a fortuitous time for us both, and I'd like to know more about you."
For the next 30 minutes, Carrie shared her experience, career plans, and ultimately the incident that had derailed her. Dr. Finley listened with rapt attention. His avuncular interest let Carrie tell him all the whys and wherefores without embarrassment. "And so I resigned," she concluded. I couldn't see how I could continue a surgical residency. But now that I've had a few weeks to think about it, I realize that doesn't mean I need to be finished with medicine. Dr. Finley added some final notes to those he'd been keeping during Carrie's story.
Well, let me tell you a little bit about our work here.
For several minutes, Dr. Finley detailed what sounded to Carrie like a typical neurological practice. The hospital had a fully staffed neurosurgical department with an accredited residency program. Together with Dr. Finley's neurology practice, they treated everything from brain tumors to migraines. But of all the work being done by the Department of Neurology and Neurosurgery at the VA, Dr. Finley was most excited about his deep brain stimulation program. He talked at length and with great enthusiasm about how DBS uses a neurostimulator placed in the brain to deliver electrical impulses to targeted regions, and the great potential it has for treating a wide range of neurological conditions. Mostly, he focused its application for treating movement disorders, and he made several references to the patient Carrie's father met during that sponsored dinner on Parkinson's disease. He hinted at other applications for DBS, but kept those allusions intentionally vague, she believed.
Look, Carrie, Dr. Finley said after his impromptu lecture on DBS, I can't offer you an actual residency position here. Our program is fully staffed, and besides, it's mid-year.
Carrie tried not to look deflated. In their brief conversation, her expectations had gone from zero to high.
But I do think I may be in a position to help, Dr. Finley continued. And I suspect what I have to offer would help renew your confidence.
I'm interested, Carrie said.
A stint with the VA would, in my opinion, increase your chances of getting back into a formal neurosurgery residency program next year, while teaching you an awful lot about brain diseases one normally doesn't deal with in the usual neurosurgery program.
If the residency positions were filled, what could he have in mind?
I could certainly do some research on depth electrode stimulation treatment for Parkinson's disease,
Carrie said, anticipating what she assumed Dr. Finley would be able to offer, some sort of research position, nothing that involved actual patients. It sounds like fascinating medicine. Again, Dr. Finley checked his notes.
I tell you what, better than that, I've got clinic on Thursday morning, and some follow-up patients will be there. Could you come?
You want me to come on rounds with you?
If you'd be so inclined.
I'm just curious, she said. If there's no residency positions, why was the timing of my call fortuitous for us both? How are you in a position to help me?
Come to rounds on Thursday, Dr. Finley said. I'll explain everything then.
Chapter 14. It felt like divine intervention to be going on rounds again. Carrie thrummed with excitement. A few days ago, she had been listless on the couch, trolling Facebook and doing what her mother always advised against, comparing her insides to everybody's outsides. But today, she was back in a hospital, about to visit with patients, and feeling both curiosity and confidence return. Carrie had dressed professionally in a blue blouse and dark slacks, but felt a bit naked without a white coat. She reminded herself that she was here to observe, nothing more, so far. Patience, first things first. Let's see what this DBS is all about. Carrie introduced herself to the receptionist. A few minutes later, a nurse took her into the neurology clinic. The aromas and sounds were instantly familiar, and she felt like a shipwrecked survivor spotting dry land. Inside exam room 8, Carrie found Dr. Finley and an obviously married couple who appeared to be in their late 60s. The man seated on the examination table was heavyset, with a horseshoe head of hair, a weather-beaten face, and loose skin all around. Petite and well put together in a dress suitable for church, the woman kept her hands interlocked in front of her. Concern for her companion was etched on her face. Dr. Finley's expression brightened on Carrie's arrival.
Dr. Bryan, he said, let me introduce you. Donald and Nancy McCall, this is Dr. Carrie Bryant. She's an accomplished neurosurgeon visiting today to learn more about DBS.
The compliment boosted Carrie's morale considerably. She was an accomplished neurosurgeon. Giving up on her career would do nothing to erase the damage she had accidentally inflicted on poor Leon. Every day, she would try and make penance. In the same way Howard Bryant double-checked each injection of phenobarbital, Carrie would take special care with pre-surgery preparations. Dr. Finley provided a brief patient history. Donald McCall had well-established Parkinson's disease, PD, and had undergone a deep brain stimulation treatment 12 weeks earlier. Carrie observed the parallel scars on Donald's scalp where cuts had been made to implant wires in his brain. A horizontal scar ran along the base of Donald's neck, and a vertical one on his chest marked the pulse generator's location. Those scars were harder to see. In time, they'd be nearly invisible. Carrie was amazed that so much technology could be so effectively concealed. Even a keen observer would have no idea Don McCall was one of the walking wired. "This is Mr. McCall's 8th visit to us," said Dr. Finley. "We're just fine-tuning the electrical settings." He turned to Nancy. "Mrs. McCall, would you mind telling Dr. Bryant a little about the changes you've observed before and after the implant?" Nancy sparked to life. "At first, I thought Don was just depressed," she said. "He stopped talking much, and when he spoke, it was like there was no feeling. And his voice got soft." Her own voice softened, as if in sympathy. "I can't say he looked sad, more like he wasn't there. And he started to stare at me for long periods, which was odd and made me uncomfortable. He slowed down, too. It was all very gradual at first. But then he started falling, and my Don had always been so balanced. He used to play ice hockey in an adult league, and now he was stooping when he walked. Then his hand started shaking. A doctor put him on some sort of antidepressant, but that didn't do anything. Don was only 55, but he acted like a man in his 80s. Carrie nodded. Nancy had her complete and undivided attention. "It was no surprise when he lost his job at Home Depot," Nancy went on. "I saw that coming miles away. Finally, what, 10 years ago now, we started seeing another doctor, and he knew it was Parkinson's just like that." Nancy snapped her fingers. "He started Don on Sinemet, and he got a lot better, but I'm sure you know the story. He started to get worse again, even after increasing his medication. He was taking it almost every hour, it seemed, trying a bunch of new stuff. It got very frustrating." Nancy reached out and caressed Don's shoulder, reminding Carrie of her parents. "Then he started developing these wild movements all over, his arms, legs, neck, and torso."
"Peak dose dyskinesia," Dr. Finley said.
Nancy said, "At other times, he seemed almost frozen solid, and it got so you couldn't tell when one state would change to another. It was like a switch."
"On-off effect," Dr. Finley elaborated.
"We saw a bunch of neurologists, but no one could do anything new or different. Then Dr. Sawyer learned about Dr. Finley's program, and since Don is a vet, 2 tours in Vietnam, he thought Don might be a good candidate for the deep brain stimulation." Nancy exhaled a protracted sigh. "I felt like I was Don's nurse for 30 hours a day." Don sat on the table, his expression vacant.
"Don, I'd like Dr. Bryant to examine you briefly, if that's okay,"
Dr. Finley said.
"Don's machine is off, and we've asked him to hold his medication this morning."
Don nodded, his stare still blank. He'd been poked and prodded by plenty of strangers before. Carrie would just be the latest. Carrie slipped back into the role of caregiver without missing a step. It really was like getting back on a bicycle, even after an ugly fall. Don had textbook PD, she thought. A pill-rolling rest tremor of right upper limb, dystonic turned-in posturing of the right foot. Don gazed unblinking out the window and showed little expression. It was easy to empathize with Nancy. The poor woman had to care for a ghost of her husband. Carrie asked Don a few simple questions, his name, birthday, and home address. His voice came out soft and stuttered, barely intelligible. Carrie helped him down from the exam table and tested his mobility. He followed her movement instructions with all the grace and fluidity of the Tin Man, classic cogwheel rigidity in all limbs. Positive glabellar tap response, classic flexed posture of the trunk. The Parkinsonian shuffle was on full display as he attempted to walk, and it was no surprise when he froze midway while turning to his left. Carrie recounted all that she had observed, and Dr. Finley looked pleased.
"A lot of neurosurgical residents who rotate through my program don't seem to know a thing about movement disorders, or show that they can conduct a decent neuro exam," he said. "You're already 2 steps ahead."
From a nearby countertop, Dr. Finley retrieved a compact device approximately the size of a deck of cards. It had a plastic case, several buttons, and a small display screen.
"This programming unit will help us fine-tune Don's stimulation settings," Dr. Finley said. "It uses radio communication to adjust the stimulus parameters of the surgically implanted unit. Last time, we set the frequency at 140 cycles per second and the pulse width at 80 milliseconds. Today, we're going to increase the voltage amplitude just a bit to 2.5.
Dr. Finley peeled away the paper covers over the sticky pads on the back of a plastic dock and adhered the unit over the scar on Don's chest. He snapped the programming device into place on the dock, then spent some time making sure the programming unit worked properly. When he was satisfied, he said,
"I'll be back in a while to take another look at you, Don, and we'll see how you're doing plugged in, as they say, and then we'll put you back on your medication and see how the whole package is working. As you know, Nancy, this is going to take some time," he added. "I'll be here checking on other folks for a while. Why don't you get yourself some coffee?"
He turned to Carrie.
"My job is to make sure the patients receive the proper dosage of medicine and stimulation. It would be up to you to get those wires precisely where they need to be. And believe me, Dr. Bryant, this is no simple feat."
Up to you? Did he mean it? Could she work here? The VA's cafeteria, even down to the food, was about what Carrie had expected. Institutional was apparently a flavor as well as a design aesthetic. Still, so far, she was enjoying every minute of her time with Dr. Finley. They had looked in on several more patients, and Dr. Finley suggested they take a coffee break before concluding with Don McCall.
"So, what did you think?"
he asked once they were seated.
"Well, the management of movement disorders is far more nuanced than I appreciated," Carrie said. "It's interesting and really necessary work."
Dr. Finley looked pleased.
"Let me be very candid with you, Carrie," he said. "I've checked your references, and I know even more about the incident we discussed in my office. Believe me, everyone at Community in White is heartsick over what happened. They really like you. And I know you saved a woman's life the night before. I've got to tell you, Metcalf is still pissed, but he's all massive ego anyway."
Carrie shrank at the mention of Metcalf's name. "I hope you didn't ask him for a reference." Dr. Finley laughed.
"I don't think you'll ever get back into his good graces, but I don't need his commendations, no talent when I see it."
"I'm really glad to hear that, but I guess I'm a bit confused," Carrie said.
"Why is that?"
"When we met in your office, you said that there were no residency openings available, but you also said my timing was fortuitous. Can you explain that now?"
A shadow crossed Dr. Finley's face. He spent a moment stirring the cream in his coffee. When he looked up, his eyes showed strain and more than a hint of sadness.
"A few weeks ago, our DBS surgeon, Sam Rockwell, was in a terrible, terrible car accident, coming back from his vacation home in Maine. I saw the photos. His car crumpled like a tin can. His condition is too tenuous to med-flight him to White Memorial, so his family has been keeping vigil at his bedside in a Bangor hospital. He's in a drug-induced coma with multi-organ failure and sepsis. There's a good chance he won't make it. It's a definite blow to our program."
"That's horrible," Carrie said, feeling a stab of sadness for Dr. Finley and for Rockwell's family.
"Sam and I were extremely close, and I'm just devastated. Anyway, there's no way Sam is coming back here anytime soon, and we need someone to take over his responsibilities. I know you would be an excellent replacement. There is some time sensitivity to this offer. I'm afraid we may lose funding for a very special initiative if we don't get someone into the role post-haste. But I can't take just anybody, and as you know, most of the qualified candidates are currently employed. We can't wait for them to become available to us."
Carrie nodded grimly. "I see now why you said my call was fortuitous. Medicine was a Darwinian world. One doc's misfortune was another doc's golden opportunity. Still, it felt ugly to profit from tragedy."
"Listen, Carrie, I know this seems wrong, given Sam's unfortunate circumstance. But a person with your considerable skill and talent would be a huge asset to us. You'd be able to jump right in without missing a beat. I've got the funds, and while this would not be a formal residency, it might help you get your groove back, so to speak. The surgical schedule is not too demanding, not at all like what you're used to. We try to limit the surgeries to one or two per week. There simply isn't a large staff to conduct proper patient evaluations and handle follow-on care.
That's a wonderful offer, Carrie began, but Finley stopped her.
But here are the restrictions, he said. You're my hire. You work for me on this, not the VA. I'd be able to pay you out of the DARPA funds, and that includes benefits. Those funds give me a tremendous degree of clout with the VA's leadership team, including the acting medical director. You won't be a part of the residency program, but that's no issue. I know you're a good surgeon, and your reputation precedes you. I know what you did for Beth Stillwell, and I thought it was remarkable. I truly believe you'd make an incredible addition to our team.
How do I get credentialed? She asked. It's going to take so long to get on board here.
Dr. Finley showed no concern.
Carrie, you have a medical license. You got that when you graduated medical school. Your residence is for training, but legally, if you wanted to go out and start a practice, you could have done that. Some people need 5 years of residency to get where they need to be. Some get it after 3, but my inquiries have persuaded me that you got it after 1 or 2. You've got enough talent, enough training to do this job. Even though I run the neurology residency at the VA, I'm hiring you under private funding for this program. It's a very unusual opportunity, and you'll be able to use this experience to enhance your credentials if you wish to get back to formal residency. Though my hope is that you'll stay with my special initiative for years to come.
And what exactly is that special initiative? An inscrutable look came to Dr. Finley's face, then it morphed into a grin.
Come with me, he said.
Carrie followed Dr. Finley back to Don McCall's hospital room, where Nancy McCall greeted them with a bright smile.
Already much improved, Nancy said.
Have a look for yourself, Dr. Finley said to Carrie.
Right away, Carrie noticed the rest tremor was significantly decreased.
How are you feeling, Don? Carrie asked as she checked the mobility of his limbs.
It was not enough to get him back on the ice, but the degree of movement made Carrie think somebody had replaced one Don with another.
I'm feeling much better, Doc, Don said.
The stutter was gone, and his voice was strong and intelligible. After her brief exam concluded, Carrie followed Dr. Finley back into the hallway.
Impressive, isn't it? Dr. Finley said.
Yes, very much so, Carrie said. But treating Parkinson's with DBS isn't all that new, at least not according to my research. So I'm still curious about that special initiative you mentioned.
What if I told you that we could use DBS to cure PTSD, not treat it, but cure it?
Adam came to Carrie's mind with a flash of wonder. How is it possible?
Could it be possible?
If that were true, Dr. Finley, Carrie said, I'd say you had yourself a brand new DBS surgeon.
Chapter 56. Carrie was on the two-way, trying to reach David, when a van pulled up to the rear entrance of the VA. The white cargo van without any windows was the kind that gave Carrie shivers anytime she passed one on the road. She set the radio down on the seat beside her and did not move. 12:30 in the morning. Floodlights partially illuminated the back lot, but not Carrie's Volvo, which was parked directly opposite the van, maybe 100 feet away. The van idled for a minute or two. No action, just waiting. Even though she was parked in the shadows, Carrie sank lower in her seat and peered out over the car's front dash. She caught a flash of movement near the van. The hospital rear doors had come open, and out stepped Lee Taggart, dressed in street clothes and pushing a wheelchair. Seated in that wheelchair was a limp-looking man covered in a gray blanket, wearing a baseball cap on his head, which was slumped forward onto his chest. He looked unresponsive, likely very sedated. It had to be Garrett McGee. The van's rear doors sprang open, and a huge figure emerged out the back. Carrie recognized him right away. It was Ramon Hernandez. She'd suspected Taggart, but Hernandez? What was he doing here? Confusion paralyzed Carrie's mind. Pieces were on the table, but she still could not put them all into the puzzle. Hernandez jumped to the ground and waited for Taggart to reach him.
Together, the two men lifted the wheelchair holding McGee into the back of the van with ease. To Carrie, to anybody, it looked like a hospital discharge, not a kidnapping. Seconds later, the van slipped into reverse and headed for the exit. And just like that, McGee was gone. Carrie waited until the van got some distance before she started her car's engine. She was short of breath, but not determination. The van took a left out of the lot, and Carrie followed. She glanced at the two-way radio on the seat beside her. No way to reach David now. He was probably in handcuffs by this point. Sick as she was about David, she could call somebody for help. From her purse, Carrie retrieved her phone without losing sight of the van. At that moment, the van made a sudden left turn, and Carrie pulled to a quick stop on the side of the road, confused. The turn made no sense to her. The van had gone down the access road to the VA's long-abandoned construction project on the hospital annex. The access road was a dead end, not a through street. Nothing was down that way but the boarded-up brick building. A few seconds of contemplation, nothing more. She had to follow. Carrie shut off her car's headlights and took the same turn as the van. It was dark and hard to see, but Carrie managed not to drive off the potholed road and into a ditch. The four-story building loomed large in front of her. Battered chain-link fencing surrounded the annex, a symbolic keep-out gesture at best. The structure was built on what appeared to be a weed-strewn sandlot dotted with rusted trash barrels. At the rear of the annex, beyond the fencing, was a dense patch of scraggly-looking trees and a sea of unruly brush. When Carrie reached the halfway point, she let up on the gas and pulled over to the side of the road. She could see the van in front of her, and that meant the people inside would be able to see her. The van drove up to the fence, and Taggart got out. He pried the fence open where there was not any gate, and secured the pliable metal flap using two bungee cords, creating a makeshift entrance wide enough for the van to drive through. They must have cut the fence so, from a distance, the perimeter would not appear to have been breached. Hernandez brought the van close to the building, but kept the engine running. Taggart stayed with McGee while Hernandez put the van in reverse and drove back through the fence opening. Carrie panicked, thinking he would drive right past her car, but instead he drove off the road and down what appeared to be a path that cut through the growth behind the annex. Just like that, the van was gone. A moment later, Hernandez emerged from a thicket of trees and brush. He went back through the fence and undid the bungee cords holding the flap in place. He caught up to Taggart, who waited for him at what must have been the rear entrance into the abandoned building. Sure enough, Taggart opened a door, and soon all three men vanished inside. Carrie rolled down her window to battle back a sudden wave of nausea. Only then did she realize she was completely soaked in sweat. She watched the building for a few minutes and felt certain nobody was coming out. Why would Hernandez have hidden the van if he planned to go somewhere anytime soon? The plan, Carrie thought. Get the evidence. Maybe there was a window, some way for her to take a picture without entering the building. A voice inside her head spoke up. She was unarmed, outnumbered, and untrained, while Hernandez was solid muscle and a skilled combat vet. No contest. Be smart here, Carrie, she said aloud. Then she remembered the call she'd been about to make. Carrie retrieved her smartphone and dialed a number stored in her contacts. The phone rang four times before somebody finally answered. Dr. Finley sounded logy.
Yeah, hello?
Alistair, it's Carrie. There's an emergency. I need your help. Her speech came out hurried and short of breath.
Carrie, what on earth? What's going on?
The VA police have my friend David Hoffman in custody right now. You have to tell them he's not a threat. He's with me.
In custody? Why? And what do you mean he's with you? What are you doing?
I don't have time to explain, but there's something terrible happening at the VA. Sandra Goodwin and Caltren are kidnapping the DBS patients.
What?
Dr. Finley sounded fully awake now and appropriately alarmed. They've been experimenting on people, Alistair, Carrie said. It's not DBS that's curing them. It's some sort of drug they've been given, I'm sure of it. Something from Cerebromed, but it doesn't always work. There are side effects like palynecusis, maybe others. And Ramon Hernandez, he's involved, same as the nurse from the VA, Lee Taggart. I just watched them take Garrett McGee off the neuro recovery unit.
Carrie, you realize you sound absolutely mad.
It's happening whether you want to believe me or not. Now please, help my friend David and call the police.
Where are you?
I'm at the VA hospital annex construction site. That's where they brought McGee.
Okay, just get out of there. Get out now.
I'll call the police and I'll call you right back. Carrie ended the call. She knew the smart thing to do. Get out. Of course, she should do just that. But a thought came to her. What if the van takes off with McGee inside before the police arrive? More proof gone. She should at least get the license plate. It might be a vital piece of evidence the police would need. Carrie scolded herself for not taking video of the two men lifting McGee into the back of the van. So much had happened so fast, she had not been thinking clearly. She could at least get a picture of the license plate and then get out of there. For Abington, for Fasciani, for all the vets who had been hurt because of Goodwin and Trent. She owed it to them. Carrie fired up the engine but kept the lights off as she drove ahead. If anybody saw her coming, she could slam the car into reverse and make a quick escape. 100 feet from the chain-link fence, Carrie pulled to the side of the road. She kept the engine running as she got out. Her feet crunched on the hard-packed dirt, and the glow of city lights in the distance shone like an artificial dawn. Blood pounded in her ears, but she could still hear the drone of millions of buzzing insects that infested the woods where the van had to be hidden. Carrie's nerves were crackling. To her left, she saw the path down which Hernandez had driven the van. She vanished inside the forest that bordered the access road and reached the van in a matter of feet. Her hands shook violently, but she managed to get a few pictures of the Massachusetts license plate. The van itself was completely unremarkable, scuffed up some, dented in places. She did not linger and was soon headed down the path back to her idling car. The whole trip took a few minutes at most. Carrie settled into the driver's seat and let the feeling of relief wash over her. As soon as her hands found the steering wheel, Carrie felt a presence rise behind her. Her eyes went to the rearview mirror, and she took it all in. The short cropped hair, strong jawline, broad shoulders. Almost immediately, Carrie recognized the silhouette of Terry Bushman, the second vet she had examined.
"Never turn your back on a Marine," Bushman said. "We're sneaky bastards."
Carrie screamed and tried to get out, but Bushman reached his powerful arm over the seat and brought it down alongside Carrie's neck. Bushman's left hand pushed against his right wrist. He made a muscle with his right arm that bulged into the side of Carrie's neck. The pressure was directly on her two carotid arteries, thankfully not her larynx or throat. 1 second. Carrie struggled to break free. 2 seconds. She tried to scream. 3 seconds. Her world was gone. Chapter 57. The first thing Carrie noticed was the smell. It was damp and mildewed, like the fetid water of a marsh. There was a whiff of urine, too, as well as a rank body odor smell that made her want to gag. She felt tender soreness on both sides of her neck, but nothing on her throat. A sick, flu-like feeling made it hard to focus. She wondered if she'd been drugged. Probably. What had happened? As her awareness became more acute, Carrie heard moaning and what sounded like people mumbling. The noises came from both her left and right, and it was different men who spoke. They made strange groaning and grunting sounds, disturbed, panicked. She could make out some of the words.
"Get down! Get down!"
The voice that spoke was sharp-edged but muted, and the words were slurred like somebody talking in their sleep. A different voice said,
"We're taking fire from the north side. Where are they at? Where are they at?"
More voices blended together. The chatter was best described as incessant, like the buzzing of the insects that occupied the woods behind the annex. Only these were human voices. Maybe half a dozen in total, mumbling simultaneously.
"I'm hit, I'm hit. Talk, talk, talk to me. Oscar, Mike? Oscar, Mike. Go, go. Clear. The rounds are firing downwind."
On and on it went, without let up, until the chorus of voices became a single droning noise that Carrie could ignore. Her eyes fluttered open, and she focused on what appeared to be the stripes of a mattress. It smelled, too, truly foul, just like the rest of the space. With great effort, Carrie managed to push onto her hands and knees. She lifted her head groggily and blinked rapidly. Her vision must not have cleared entirely, because what she saw made no sense to her. It looked like she was inside a dog kennel of some kind. Galvanized tubular frames held in place heavy-duty gauge chain-link wire. The wire covered all sides of the welded structure, including the top. The single door, framed with galvanized tubes and covered in wire, was secured with a heavy chain and a heavy-duty padlock. Carrie looked right and saw three additional kennels all in a row. Inside each wired enclosure was a thin and dirty man. Each of the three men sported a different stage of facial hair growth, as if it marked the length of his stay here. One had stubble, one had a full beard, and one looked like the Taliban. The man in the cage closest to Carrie rested on a grimy mattress, while the other two paced about their enclosures like animals at the zoo. Each man had sunken hollow eyes and a vacant stare. Those who moved about ambled with a zombie's gait. They wore blue hospital scrubs that were soiled and tattered, and in such deplorable condition it made them look like shipwrecked survivors. Affixed to each man's arm was an IV drip, secured in place with tape and hooked to a rolling metal IV stand. All three men muttered to themselves and seemed completely oblivious to Carrie's presence. Inside each kennel was a blue bucket into which Carrie watched one man urinate. Water bottles were strewn about, and trays with food scraps attracted a large congregation of buzzing flies. The cement floor, the color of rust, was damp with puddles and chipped in spots. Carrie noticed several coiled-up hoses outside the cages, showers, she thought, and drains spaced throughout to capture any excess water. Lining a concrete wall to Carrie's left was a bank of decrepit-looking washing machines and dryers, some fallen over, some with broken glass and dimpled sides, all industrial strength. She knew then that this was the abandoned laundry facility of the old annex building. A tall pile of industrial laundry machines, like a mini mountain of junkyard scrap, occupied a sizable area in the center of the cavernous space. Carrie believed she was in a subterranean room, with thick concrete columns peppered throughout to distribute and support the building's substantial weight. Overhead banks of fluorescent lights lit the old laundry facility from above and flickered on and off as if they were sending Morse code.
"Hey, why are you standing? Get the hell down or get shot."
Carrie spun her head in the direction of the voice. Three more kennels stood to her left, but only two had people inside them. The far cage appeared to hold the man Carrie believed to be Garrett McGee. The person in the cage closest to her, who had ordered her down, caused Carrie's jaw to come unhinged. It was Eric Fasciani. He was skeletal-looking, fierce with his gaze, haunted in every way imaginable. Like the others, Fasciani wore soiled scrubs. His thin arms were covered in scabbed-over scratches, and Carrie noticed gruesome scratches on his neck as well. His face was bearded like the other men. Nobody shaved them. Nobody took care of them. Lab rats were treated better than this, at least for a while. "Eric, what are you doing here? What is this place?" Carrie spoke in a hushed whisper, afraid someone might come for her.
"What are you doing? What are you doing? Stop saying that. Got Taliban crawling all over the place. We're gonna have to shoot our way out."
"Eric, please, talk to me. Tell me what's happening here."
"He can't hear you, Carrie Bryant. Not really. Not in the way you understand it."
Carrie's breath caught at the sound of the man's voice.
Her heart sank and her spirit cracked wide open.
For a few frozen moments, Carrie could not move. She swallowed a jet of bile as the fear set in and anger cooked inside. With gritted teeth, Carrie wheeled and set her frightened gaze on the man who spoke. Dr. Alistair Finley. Chapter 58.
"What the hell are you doing?" Carrie screamed at Dr. Finley. "Let me go! Let me out of here!"
Dressed in his trademark Oxford shirt and khaki pants, Dr. Finley had a pressed, clean appearance that made the other men's condition look even more deplorable. He approached with honest sympathy in his eyes, almost a look of heartache, as though he knew Carrie's fate and deeply regretted it. He came over to her kennel and locked his fingers around the wire. Meanwhile, Fasciani continued to bark and mutter and speak unintelligibly, but Carrie no longer concentrated on what he said. Her entire focus remained on Dr. Finley and three men who accompanied him into this dank cellar: Terry Bushman, Ramon Hernandez, and Lee Taggart, who held in his hands a long rod-like implement with two pointed prongs on the end. A few of the men in cages took notice of the cattle prod in Taggart's hand and sank to the back of their kennels as though they'd been conditioned to react that way. Carrie lunged at the wire, causing Dr. Finley to rip his hands away before she could grab them. With as much force as she could muster, Carrie shook the cage, but managed to make it rattle and nothing more. These kennels were bolted into the cement and would not budge no matter how much she tried. None of the men down here, those inside the cages or out, reacted to Carrie's rage.
"You need to calm down, Carrie," Dr. Finley said. "Nobody can hear you scream. Your outbursts will do you no good, and I have questions to ask, important questions. If you yell or don't cooperate, Braxton will administer a painful shock with this livestock prod."
"Braxton?" Carrie said. Dr. Finley became aware of Carrie's confusion.
"Ah, of course. Nurse Lee Taggart is in actuality Braxton Price, and he's as skilled as these other two gentlemen, if not more so. So you'll need to cooperate now, Carrie. It's vital for you."
Carrie focused her thoughts to compartmentalize her fear and terror. "What is this? What's going on here?" Dr. Finley kept some distance from the cage as he removed his spectacles and rubbed at his eyes.
"This, Carrie," Dr. Finley said, gesturing to the kennels of men, "is how we're going to cure PTSD.
Carrie hated to hear Dr. Finley speak her name. It felt like another violation of her trust. She shook her head, disbelieving. She focused on the words the men in these cages spoke, play-acted, it now seemed. And Carrie understood in a way she had not before that they seemed to be trapped inside a virtual reality simulation, one of war and bloodshed, a place where the gunfire never let up.
"What have you done to them?"
"Easy does it," Carrie warned herself. "Don't lose your temper. They'll hurt you if you do."
"I'm helping them," Dr. Finley said. "Well, not them exactly, but others like them. These men are pioneers, Carrie. These are men who will give us a window into the secret world of the traumatized brain. These men are heroes."
Carrie's sense of Dr. Finley's program was coming into sharper focus. A sickly chill overtook her.
"They're all homeless, aren't they?" she whispered. "Like Steve, like Eric. These men are vets who were living on the street, people nobody noticed and nobody missed."
"They fit the criteria we needed."
"And you?"
Carrie's eyes turned fierce as she set her gaze on Ramon Hernandez and Terry Bushman.
"You were like them. You were on the streets, too. How could you let this happen to these men?"
"Actually," Dr. Finley said, "Ramon and Terry weren't like them at all. They're both former members of Braxton's military squad, and they help to, let's call it recruit vets for our program. I was quite impressed when you discovered Ramon had a connection to Steve Abington that preceded our efforts here. You're a very clever woman."
Carrie gripped the wires again.
"But you cured them both," she said.
"No," Dr. Finley answered. "I performed DBS surgery on them, and that's all. These men never had PTSD. And their implants produce no electrical discharge. To be blunt, they are part of our dog and pony show for the federal government to ensure we continue to receive more funding. You see, Caltrans needed to show progress to the higher-ups at DARPA, and sadly, vets like Steve Abington were not going to do the trick. Not yet, anyway."
"What is this?" Carrie said, gesturing to Eric's IV drip. "What is in those IVs? What had she gotten herself into?"
"You actually had it figured out, Carrie," Dr. Finley said. "You just didn't quite put it all together."
"Cerebromed," Carrie said. "Bob Richardson."
"Richardson and Cerebromed," Dr. Finley repeated. "But it's not all Bob's doing, not by a long shot. I had the basis for the chemical properties of deliratum and brought it to Richardson's attention."
"Deliratum?" Carrie asked.
"From the Latin verb meaning to erase."
Dr. Finley's ego and overweening pride would keep him talking, revealing secrets Carrie longed to know but dreaded to hear.
"What is deliratum?" Carrie spat out the word.
"It's a drug, Carrie, that reconsolidates bad memories causing PTSD symptoms,"
Dr. Finley answered matter-of-factly.
"The drug is a highly modified form of MDMA, which you know better as the street drug, ecstasy.
Our lab is located down here, but I'm sure you had no idea. There are no nasty fumes, and not a lot of highly suspicious chemicals involved. Richardson is our supplier, and that service can't be undervalued. CerebroMed has been after something like this for years. Richardson stands to make a lot of money from this discovery, but money isn't everything. Carrie was aware that the compounds found in MDMA had been shown to dampen the amygdala, which would allow people to re-engage with the negative experiences without significant consequence.
It all has to do with perseverating memory, Dr. Finley continued. We needed a way to trigger the memory so that it persisted in the amygdala, where we would then use DBS to neutralize the emotion. The problem was getting the memory to perseverate properly.
Carrie's eyes went wide with a look of horror. Virtual reality didn't work, did it? You needed drugs to make it happen, she said.
We needed drugs and a way to test them. Animals aren't very good at telling us their feelings. It might not look to you like we're close to a breakthrough here, but we are. A few more trials and we'll have something truly remarkable.
But these drugs don't work, Carrie said. These men are lost.
Well, they do in some ways. It's a process, you see.
Carrie's thoughts were gelling, and those disparate threads Dr. Finley had referenced connected in ways she could not possibly have imagined. The word that flashed in her mind like neon on Broadway was perseverate. It meant a thought or action repeated long after a stimulus that prompted a response had ceased. For some of these men, deliratum made the war live on in their minds. Their trauma continued unabated, perseverated, in medical parlance. But for some, that perseveration manifested as palinacusis. Dr. Finley observed Carrie thoughtfully.
So, you understand now, don't you?
Carrie felt gravely ill, weak throughout her body. Have you cured anybody? She asked. Dr. Finley appeared a bit contrite.
There are flashes of real lucidity, yes, and the length varies, sometimes weeks. But eventually significant deteriorations recur. A few of the patients just have the palinacusis side effect, no lingering PTSD symptoms, but that's happened only a handful of times. Of course, those are the ones we're most excited about.
Carrie felt confused. Steve Havington, he communicated with me. He talked about his friend Roach before he attacked me. Was he one of those men? Is he still alive?
No, I'm afraid not. The sedatives we gave him pre-op dampened the effects of deliratum significantly, but as soon as those drugs wore off, he was completely lost. Same as your friend Eric here.
Carrie looked down the row of cages. None of them appeared to be engaged with reality. But you said some people just have the palinacusis side effect. Where are those men?
They didn't make it.
Make it? What do, Alistair? Just execute them?
They might have trouble with hearing, Dr. Finley said, but their mouths work just fine.
You're a monster, Carrie said. All of you. Monsters. Hernandez took a threatening step toward Carrie's cage. She retreated a few steps, forgetting for a moment the barrier between them.
These guys were gone anyway, Hernandez said. Why not put the body and mind to good use?
And what do you get out of this deal? Carrie asked bitterly.
Me?
Hernandez touched a finger to his chest.
I'm helping to fix one of the biggest problems in the military and make a fortune doing it. What more do you want?
Is that it for you, Alistair? Carrie asked. Is it about the money?
No, Dr. Finley said with a shake of his head. It's about the results. Think about what a drug like deliratum can do for the world. The trauma of war, of rape, of child abuse, fatal accidents, death, and grief. All of it can be neutralized. I can bring happiness to the world. True peace of mind. What's that worth, Carrie? I think it's worth the sacrifice of these men.
I think you don't want to go through the proper channels and develop a drug under the guidelines of the FDA. I think you want your glory, and you want it now. Dr. Finley shrugged off the rebuke.
There's a certain truth to what you say, he admitted. I would like to be alive when I finally get the recognition and respect I deserve. Who wouldn't want to go down in history as the person who unlocked the secrets of the mind?
And Sandra Goodwin will have a state-of-the-art neurological practice to run. I guess she gets something out of the deal, too, Carrie said.
We all have our motivations in life, Dr. Finley said.
Carrie shook on the inside and out. Whether it was hubris or ego, Dr. Finley needed Carrie to understand his motives, to accept them if possible. Sam Rockwell.